95.7 Ben FM Philadelphia presents Her Story, hosted by Kathy Romano. Her Story is a weekly tribute to women making a major difference in the lives of others by telling her story.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most fans of country music, we're excited to learn that Luke Combs was back in the studio working on his next album. We've come up with our list of iconic Luke Combs music videos. Yes, Lovin' On You made the cut. Text Luke to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Luke to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone.
95.7 Ben FM presents Her Story with Kathy Romano.
Good morning and welcome to Her Story. I'm your host, Kathy Romano. Today's guest grew up on a wealthy estate in Radnor, Pennsylvania, attended Harvard University, and is the author of the New York Times bestseller, A Singular Woman, The Untold Story of Barack Obama's Mother. Janie Scott was a reporter for the New York Times from 1994 to 2008 and was a member of the Times reporting team that won the 2000 Pulitzer Prize for National Reporting. Her new book shares the tale of her family's fortunes and her father, Robert Montgomery Scott. The name of the book is The Beneficiary, Fortune, Misfortune, and the Story of My Father. It provides a look into the weight of inheritance, addiction, and the power of buried secrets. Please welcome author Janie Scott. Hi, Janie.
Hi, Kathy. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for coming by. You grew up in Radnor on an estate that still sits there today. Tell me about where you grew up.
The place was called Ardrossan. It was at its height, in probably in the 60s, about 800 acres of rolling farmland and beautiful stone farmhouses. It had been pieced together in the early 20th century by my great-grandfather. And by the time I was born in the mid-50s, four generations of my father's family was living there. It was also a working dairy farm with a herd of roughly 300 Ayrshire cows.
And what is it today?
Smaller. It's in the process of being dismantled. After a couple of sales in the 90s and early 2000s, there were 330 acres remaining, and those are now being sold off in a five-phase sale, and all that will remain ultimately is 15 acres and the house that my great-grandparents built, a 50-room mansion, which will remain on 15 acres.
So from 800 to 15.
That's right.
Why did you decide to write the book?
I had spent the first 14 years of my life in this place. Of course, as a child, I didn't understand how unusual and rarefied it was. Then my family moved away. My father got a job in London, and we moved to England for 4 years. And so when we came back, I never really lived there again. My parents returned there, but I was in college and then off on my own and working in other parts of the country. Over time, I came to see what an unusual place that was and how little I'd really understood about it as a child. And after my father died, a figure who was well known in Philadelphia and who was of considerable interest to me, a very appealing, charming, but also somewhat puzzling character, I discovered that there were in this house a load of papers of sort of, you know, documents of family history that tracked the creation of that place in the early 20th century and its evolution over the course of the 20th century. So I just thought it would be interesting to go look at those papers. And once you get into something like that, you start to think about it as a story. And I figured, okay, I'm going to try to write the story of the creation and evolution of this place. And in the process, perhaps I would come to understand something about my father, who had died in 2005 of cirrhosis in a rather, I thought, dark end to a seemingly charmed life.
So talk a little bit more about your dad, because a lot of the book is focused on him.
My father is best known in Philadelphia as having been for 16 years the president and CEO of the Philadelphia Museum of Art, which he did until the mid-90s. But he was also a big civic figure in other institutions. He was president of the Academy of Music. He was involved in many, many arts and cultural organizations and hospitals and banks, etc. He was a product of the world that his great-grandparents had created. He grew up on that place, Ardrossan in Villanova, and he then went off to college and came back right afterward and went to Penn Law School and then basically lived there for pretty much his entire life, except for 4 years in London. He moved into a house one field away from his parents. When he and my mother had their second child, they moved to the house next door, which was two fields away from his parents. So he embedded himself in this world, and he was, to all external appearance, totally a product of it. This kind of public-spirited patrician who did a lot of good things in Philadelphia was seemingly extremely gregarious. So he was well known for his sort of outer presentation, but within the intimacy of the family, he was a much more quiet, brooding, somewhat perplexing figure.
Was there a dark side to him?
Well, it turned out there was. I mean, I didn't understand him as a child. I adored him and was kind of fascinated by him. What happened in the course of working on this book was he had told me in my 20s that he wanted me to have his diaries when he died. I was completely flabbergasted by this offer, which came utterly out of the blue. And all I could think to say was, well, why me? And he said, you're the writer. And we never discussed it again. I didn't dare bring it up because I was afraid that he would withdraw the offer. And when he died in 2005, the diaries were nowhere to be found. Years later, when I got interested in this book, I tried to find them and got hold of a couple which were in the possession of the girlfriend he had at the end of his life. And then I inadvertently stumbled upon a single diary in the basement of my mother's house on this place, which she had later bought in one of the earlier sales. And it was a remarkable thing, a diary written by my father in his mid-20s when he was first having children and he was settling into his life. And it was extraordinarily revealing and beautifully written and showed me for the first time in his own words his account of his sort of emotional and mental state. He felt, it turned out, that he had some kind of cyclical depression, and he had been treating it for most of his life with alcohol, which enabled him to get over his inhibitions. I went on from that point to search the entire house, and to my amazement, I found all the diaries locked in a chest in a closet on the third floor with a padlock set to one digit off the last four digits of my parents' phone number. In other words, set to a place where anyone who found it could figure out how to open it.
Did your mother know about these diaries?
It appears not, and I believe that she didn't. We all knew that he kept diaries, but none of us knew what happened to them. It's a large house, as we say. It has 9 bathrooms. And so this thing, this chest with the diaries, at some point before his death, and I don't know when because he'd moved out of the house about 10 years before he died, he had stowed these in there and left them there under lock. She never, you know, I guess never went into that closet, never noticed the box. I'm quite convinced she didn't know they were there.
And I guess just didn't look for them.
Exactly. I don't think they had divorced after he moved out, and I don't think she had any real appetite for that.
In the book, do you touch any more on his addiction, or was it just that he was self-medicating with alcohol?
The book spans 100 years in my father's family, going from the inception of Ardrossan, that estate, through his death in 2005. And the first half of the book is a lot about the sort of history and rise of that place and my great-grandparents and my grandparents. My grandmother was thought to be the model for Tracy Lord in the Philadelphia story. So they have their own stories. And then the second half of the book really gets into my father. And you see him as I saw him as a child. When I was a child, you know, very lively and fun and full of adventure and funny, but also a little bit dark with occasional references to the black dog, a term I now know Winston Churchill used for his deep, dark depressions. And also, I knew all along that he drank a lot. Yes, over time, it gets worse and worse, and we eventually force him into treatment, which he undergoes with sort of gritted teeth. And then he comes out, and we all knew that 8 months later or so, he fell off the wagon and then continued to drink for the rest of his life, and it eventually killed him. What I discovered from the diaries was his private struggle with it, which went on for his entire adult life while he denied to us that he had a problem. He was highly aware of it from a very young age. I mean, he started drinking in his adolescence, and he was clearly conscious by that early diary in his mid-20s that he had a serious problem. And even after he came out of treatment, when we thought he kind of just slid back into his old ways, he wrestled with the problem in a way that I found very moving.
Mm. It's amazing that you have those diaries and you're reading exactly what he wrote. To me, that's so interesting.
I think many people would, in a weird way, envy that you could learn something that private about your parents, about one of your parents. People have told me what a strange kind of gift it is. But it's a very complicated gift. If he wanted me to have them and he said it was because I was a writer, what did he mean me to do with them? Would he have approved of this book, which is rather revealing of intimate aspects of his life, or would he disapprove of this?
Not that you were waiting for your father to die, but when he did you immediately think of the diaries and what he had told you?
I had young children at the time, and I was working for the New York Times, and I was very busy. And of course, I was conscious, well, there's that offer of the diaries. I had never forgotten that. But I did not go scrounging through all his possessions. I mean, they didn't surface. If they surfaced among my siblings and I in clearing out his apartment and his girlfriend, I think had they surfaced, I would have claimed them. And I don't think anyone would have had a problem with that. But I didn't really focus on it that much then because I figured, okay, well, if they're out there eventually, I'll find them. But I came to think they'd probably been destroyed.
You mentioned your grandmother. She was sort of like a socialite of her time.
Yes. Her name was Helen Hope Montgomery Scott. Her parents, Robert Leeming Montgomery and Charlotte Hope Vinnie Tyler Montgomery, had created Ardrossan. They built the house in 1912 to 1914, and they raised their four children there. She was the oldest daughter, very charismatic, disciplined, funny, flirtatious, attractive woman who I like to think in a different place and time would have been one of those powerful, interesting female senators from Texas. But anyway, she grew up in that house and she was an extraordinary horsewoman. She did a lot of fox hunting and riding. She was a pillar of the Devon Horse Show for decades. She married a man named Edgar Scott, who was grandson of a president of the Pennsylvania Railroad at the time when the railroad was the largest freight carrier in the world and the most profitable corporation in North America. So you had two fortunes. Her father had made money in finance and his grandfather had made money in railroads, two fortunes kind of coming together. They lived on that place and she ran after her father died. She took over the dairy farm, which at that point was rather neglected, and turned it into what was said to be at times the most productive dairy or Ayrshire herd of its size in the country. She was very funny. She had a whole repertoire of racy jokes. She was once said to have bought a horse for a tin of caviar and a dirty joke for every week for a year. Really a colorful character who became something of a celebrity in this area in Philadelphia because of this association with the Philadelphia story. And when she died, the Philadelphia Inquirer stripped her obituary across the top of the front page using a headline type roughly the size they used later for the Pope.
Oh my gosh, wow. Is it still a dairy farm?
No. After my grandmother died, it turned out, of course, the place had been losing money year after year, hand over fist. And my grandmother had been keeping it afloat through various acts of sort of, you know, statistical fiddling and by subsidizing it with her own money. But very quickly, the family realized they can't do this anymore, which was sad because there was a whole economy that depended on that farm. There were farmers who, multi-generational farmers who had lived on the estate and, you know, taking care of the land and the cows, and their wives had worked in the houses, and they were all put out of work almost entirely when the cows were sold. They were sold to a doctor in Colorado who had his own Ayrshire herd out there, and they were shipped out there. And I interviewed the doctor a few years ago, and he told me that basically there's none of them are left.
None of them are left.
Yeah, the ones that were sent out there were all descendants, direct descendants of the original nine that my grandmother's father had installed. They'd been acquired from Scotland. The whole thing is sort of history now.
Yeah, that's kind of sad too, though.
Kind of.
So you talk about some of the secrets that you uncovered during your research for this book. Was there any that really shocked you or was very incriminating?
No crimes, exactly, to get to the specific definition of incriminating, but lots of things that went against the family mythology. My father's father's father, that would be my father's paternal grandfather, who was the son of the railroad king. That guy's name was Thomas Alexander Scott. The son was another Edgar Scott. Everybody was named Edgar in this book. He was said to have died heroically in World War I, and he was a great sportsman. He belonged to all sorts of clubs, and up and down the East Coast in athletic clubs that he belonged to, you can find his name on plaques on the wall listing all the members who died heroically in World War I. And that was sort of the story in the family to some extent initially. It turned out, and this had been leaked out through my grandmother, not my grandfather, who never talked about his father. It had been leaked out that, in fact, he committed suicide. And I was able to find the whole story largely through a set of letters that had survived in a suitcase in the basement of a house in Wellesley, Massachusetts, owned by a distant cousin of my father's. And these letters told exactly how my father's grandfather had gone off to France with my grandfather at the end of World War One, ostensibly toward the end of World War One, to drive ambulances, and how my grandfather had done exactly that, but his father had kind of bounced around and hadn't kind of got his stuff together. He had almost never worked in his life, and he was in his mid-40s at this point, and he did finally get a job in France as a translator, but he got sick and was sent off to recover and instead went off to Paris on some kind of a bender involving supposedly drinking and women. And when he returned and was confronted and was told, look, you know, if you were in a different position, you'd be subject to court-martial, he faced the possibility of public humiliation and shame because he was the son of this enormously rich American. And so he shot himself in the head.
Wow. I think if I found these letters and these diaries, I would be so excited.
Well, it's like private detective kind of work or something. You're constantly trying to piece together the next piece. And yes, it's a little, if you could step back, you'd feel ecstatic, but it's kind of one more step along this strange process. I mean, my father's diaries, I couldn't believe that I'd found them. And there they were in this box, you know, 40 years worth of diaries in identical black three-ring binders, covered over in paper and all organized chronologically. But of course, the next thing you think is, okay, I'm going to spend the next 4 months reading these things.
Did your mother know about the things in the diaries?
I think she knew a lot about it. My father, one of the things that's evident in the diaries, my father was not a great believer in monogamy. My parents didn't have the most perfect marriage. And my father was not particularly secretive about the fact that he had affairs. And at some point, he was kind of living a second life in Philadelphia. My mother was in the house in the suburb. My mother's a musician, so she has her own career. My father has his job at the museum, and he has a girlfriend living in Philadelphia. And that aspect of it wasn't a big surprise to me that he had been involved with somebody else while he was involved with my mother. But that aspect of it, of where he, you see his juggling these two lives, not necessarily secretively, but just the logistical burden of going back and forth between multiple households. It's not that the overall fact was new, but the details were stunning and made me feel badly for him, frankly.
You mentioned earlier the estate went from 800 acres to 15. Once it's all said and done, who will own those 15 acres?
Well, the way it was set up, my great-grandparents, as I understand it, put almost everything into a series of trusts that would last for a number of generations. This was a way partly of preservation of the whole enterprise, and it was also probably a form of tax avoidance or tax reduction. So these trusts gradually expire, and that's what's some of what's precipitated some of the sales. The trust that holds that big house and the 15 acres, I believe, has expired. And then that is, at least the house is held by a 501c3 organized by the family, I think mainly as a holding pattern before they decide what they're going to do with that one final possession.
So did you or do you see any financial benefit from being a part of that family and, I guess, having some ownership in the estate?
Yes, not at the moment any huge benefit, but the way the trusts are set up, they spin off a certain amount of income, which is divided up among the proliferating number of descendants. So yes, we all have some money that comes from those certain generations. I mean, it's the older generation that mainly gets the money. In my immediate family, my father died. So what was his money is now subdivided by three among my siblings and me.
And your family didn't just own an estate in Radnor. There were others?
The immediate family had that, although the Montgomerys, my father's grandparents, did for a while buy a place in South Carolina. This was another sort of mysterious thing to me as a child. I knew that my great-grandmother, this very New England figure, disappeared every winter to a plantation in South Carolina. And the main exposure I had to it, because my parents almost never went there, was that hand-bottled caviar would come up in boxes from South Carolina and would be in my parents' freezer. It was like ball jars. It wasn't like fancy things of caviar that, you know, coming from Russia. They were from the sturgeon in the river where this house, where this plantation was. So I never really understood what that was all about. about. And years later, just out of curiosity, I happened to be in South Carolina after one of the hurricanes, and I was staying with a friend, and we thought, well, why don't we go and see what happened to that place? And lo and behold, there it was. It was kind of a ruin at the time, but it's a slavery era plantation originally with the original slave houses still there.
Oh, wow.
So it's kind of strange, frankly, and it's now been restored and turned into a bed and breakfast. They sold it in the 1970s. Yeah, we went in on that particular occasion we didn't, but I went back when I was working on the book and did see that the bed and breakfast. And when my great grandparents owned that place, they had restored some of those slave cottages. They had employees living in them, and they also built other cottages as guest houses. All of that is kind of still intact.
So when you went, did they have any information for you? Did they know the history of it?
Oh, absolutely. Okay. Yeah, there's. It's now got a website. It's called Mansfield Plantation. The whole history of it's on the website. The people who own it now are from Southern families who had owned it before and eventually had to sell it. The interesting thing that happened in South Carolina after the Civil War was that the whole rice industry changed completely because of the lack of free labor, frankly. And all these plantations fell upon hard times, and Northerners in the late 19th century went down there and started buying them up and using them for shooting places, like to shoot duck who were coming across and wintering in the rice fields. So there was this whole movement of people, including other people in Philadelphia, to go down there and buy up these places and go down there and, in my father's family, as my grandmother put it, drink themselves to death.
What was the property in Darby?
That was on my grandfather's side. You're right. There's yet another. There's several others. On my grandfather's side, the Scott side, his father, the one who ended up committing suicide in France, they had lived in Rittenhouse Square when he was young. And then, against his wife's best judgment, they moved to this place in Lansdowne. That's the one you're talking about, I'm assuming.
Yes.
Yeah, called Woodburn, which was another enormous house designed by the same architect or the same firm that did Ardrossan, Horace Trumbauer, which is the firm that designed the Philadelphia Museum of Art and Widener Library at Harvard, et cetera. So I guess the fashionable thing, if you had a lot of money, was to hire Horace Trumbauer and build yourself a gigantic house, which is exactly what my grandfather's father did. That house, his wife never liked it. She sold it after he died. She sold it and moved to a more manageable house on the main line. And it's had a very troubled history and is now kind of abandoned. I think there's an attempt by the community to save it, but I would say that's probably a long uphill battle.
What was the story that won you the Pulitzer Prize?
Well, it wasn't me personally. It was a team, but it was a very interesting project done in 99 and 2000 called How Races Lived in America. It was at a time when there was a feeling that race had ceased to be sort of top of mind. This was a time very different than now, I'd say, and that it had kind of been submerged. And the idea of the editor, a very interesting, inspired editor at the Times, then named Soma Golden Bear, was to get inside cross-racial relationships, not romantic relationships necessarily, but working relationships in the police department, in the entertainment industry, see what it's like for people who exist in these multiracial work situations or life situations and what the subtext is. So we were all assigned to go out and find in different areas. One woman did in journalism. I did one, a piece looking at the relationship between David Simon, who's since become very famous for The Wire and Tremé and, I guess, The Deuce, wonderful TV shows on HBO. He was doing a miniseries based in West Baltimore that was directed by Charles Dutton, an African-American actor and director who had grown up in that community. David Simon had been a police reporter for the Baltimore Sun. He was white. Charles Dutton was African-American. And it was looking at the sort of dynamics between the two of them as they made this miniseries, which was about drug dealing on a particular corner in Baltimore. It was a fascinating piece. So that was my contribution to that multi-part series, which did win the 2000 Pulitzer for national reporting.
Very impressive. You do so many interesting stories. The new book is called The Beneficiary, Fortune, Misfortune, and the Story of My Father by Janny Scott. Janny, where can people get the book?
Pretty much anywhere. I have a website, janny@jannyscott.com, and you can click on that, and there are links to, you know, Amazon and independent bookstores, whatever your preference is, but you can get it anywhere.
It's a great book. I haven't read the entire thing yet. I did read part of it.
Thank you, Kathy.
Janny, thank you so much for coming by today.
It's a pleasure.
And thank you so much for joining me again today. If you missed any part of Jani's interview, you can go to the website, 957benfm.com. You click on the Her Story link, and Jani's podcast will be available on Monday. Thank you so much for joining me. I'm Kathy Romano. Have a great rest of your Sunday.
This has been Her Story with Kathy Romano. Her Story is produced by WBEN-FM in Philadelphia and airs weekly or on demand on your mobile device. Listen or subscribe at 957benfm.com.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most fans of country music, we're excited to learn that Luke Combs was back in the studio working on his next album. We've come up with our list of iconic Luke Combs music videos. Yes, Lovin' On You made the cut. Text Luke to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Luke to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone.